Hello, dear heart. Welcome to the Flourishing Practitioners podcast, where we talk all things about space holding, caring for our clients, and succeeding in our businesses. We explore the wisdom from coaches, counselors, and healers. My name's Gabrielle Walker, and I'm so honored that you're here. Let's dive in.
We have spoken about it a bit as I have been talking on these different podcasts. Yeah, I'm in a period of transition, and one of the choices I made is that I want to gift more of my time to these interviews and to these podcasts. There are so many beautiful nuances in the space, so many different practices, and it's exciting to share them all with you. I'm in a period of transition, and one of the choices I've made is that I want to gift more of my time to these interviews and to these podcasts. So feel free to reach out if you know someone who you think would be a good guest, or if you have anything you would like to know more about. I would love to hear how these are landing with and for you. It inspires me to keep recording. Best place is probably my Instagram, Turahanga Flourish, or Turahanga Wellness on Facebook. I am excited to share Chelsea King with you today. She is a youth worker, and the conversation we had was really inspiring. We went across a number of personal and professional landscapes. I've known Chelsea through Hakapa Life and Corroboree for Life, but in passing, this was one of the longest times that we've been able to have a conversation, and it was really deeply enjoyable. I really value how Chelsea provided both practical insights to practitioners for working with people who are at risk, young mothers or youth. And some of those examples were creating different scenarios of what different choice points may create and what the outcomes could be, and really walking them through the implications of that if they're not perhaps having the understanding of what those choices may entail, and also starting to do referrals with your clients there, getting them to understand the process so that they see the work you're doing that we often do behind the scenes, and they're being educated on the process. I think this is such valuable insight for counselors and for practitioners. I feel like this conversation and the way that Chelsea spoke articulates the practicalities of working alongside people, and also the respect for being on this budja, on this whenua, on this land that we live on, and also the other lands that we engage with. There was also one point where I couldn't remember the act where children were taken in WA, and there was an act as part of the White Australia policy, and it's the 1905 Act where the Chief Protector O'Neill was able to take legal guardianship over Aboriginal children. And this resulted in the forced removal of many children, particularly children who were of mixed ancestry. So those who had Indigenous and non-Indigenous parentage. And WA had some of the harshest policies, some of the harshest enactments of these laws. And this continued. Many people say that current day policies in WA and Australia are in extension of this. And so the implications for Aboriginal people in WA have been huge. It's heartbreaking. The implications are palpable in many instances. And I honestly bow down to all Indigenous peoples who continue to fight for a better future for next generations. So let's jump into the podcast.
Hi everyone, today I have Chelsea King with me, who is a youth worker, beautiful wahine, and who works with young people in WA and is here today. We're going to be looking at your journey and some things that we can learn as other professionals around young people taken into care. We call all the people and energetics in the world to land with us here today so that the things we share reach the people who need to hear them. And welcome, Chelsea.
Thank you for having me.
So I always like to start with the question on what's on your heart today. And it doesn't have to be related to what we are talking about. What's sitting in your heart today?
what's on my heart at the moment. Being Māori and working on Noongar country, I'd like to acknowledge that this podcast is coming from Noongar country, Whadjuk Noongar, and we acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land that we live on, work on, and where we're meeting, and their connections to the land, to the sea, and to the waterways around us. Always was, always will be Aboriginal land. So always knowing where our footsteps are walking on, and that this land's ancient and it was different before. So I guess on my heart as well, as I always walk with those soft footsteps and have a listening of the land as well. Also being able to share knowledge, working in this space, and whether it's voluntary work, whether you have a passion for wanting to make a difference to the lives of young people out there, or maybe people that are struggling a bit and they need a bit of support, and just, yeah, sharing knowledge around that.
Thank you. Would you be able to share where you're from, what brings you to Perth, to here, to this moment? What's sitting there?
I come over to Perth when I was 18 months old with my family. I was born in Dunedin, and we come over to Sydney first. We were only there for a little bit, and then we moved here and settled here. Yeah, grown up in the KGB.
What KGB?
So Kundalla Balga Mirrabooka.
Oh, okay.
Just the place of belonging for a lot of people up in that area. And, you know, if people hear that, they connect instantly. Grew up there with my parents and my siblings. I grew up around a lot of mob, a lot of different cultures. It was a very multicultural area as well. So really grateful for that upbringing and those connections that I've had. My connections back home in New Zealand, Aotearoa, is Ngāpuhi. My father's from Moriwa, Kawakawa area. And my mum's side is from Dunedin, Karatani, Stewart Island in the South Island. So yeah, I still have a lot of journeys to be had back home. I'm 38 now, so I've grown up here my whole life. I'm a mum. I have two children, 19 and 22 years old. So yeah, they're out there and doing their thing in the world.
I really want to acknowledge, because I notice sometimes when we look at like the mainstream media at home, Aotearoa home. I feel like here is home. Honestly, someone asked me the other day, where's home? And I thought, first thought was Perth. Lots of people in New Zealand don't have that understanding of like the breadth of the community we have here and the intermingling of cultures, how we weave with Aboriginal, Māori and non-Māori and non-Aboriginal as well.
On that, I guess I also call here home. Like, this is my home here as well, and also New Zealand. I also acknowledge that I'm a visitor here, and there's nothing else around that for me. It's just a knowing, a sense of knowing that, you know, I am in the lands that I walk on and the people that are the First Nations people. This is, you know, their budja. So really, it's really important to me. And my son's actually Noongar, so, you know, my connections is also through him as well to this land.
Thank you. So what led you to step into being a youth worker? What was your journey to this moment?
Yeah. Well, I worked in high school, so the public secondary schools, I guess, from my early 20s. But I guess going back further, I had my son when I was 15 years old and my daughter when I was 18 years old. So I was a really young mum and had to navigate that space. So I think that started back then, just my journey, being able to finish my education, balance or juggle life, being a teenage mum, returning to school. So yeah, juggling like being a teenage mum, going to school, full-time school, to finish year 11 and 12, and also like moving out of home and, you know, managing a household. So I think it starts back to going through those challenges that came with all of that. You know, I always had a drive to buy my own house, and so that really motivated me to keep growing and learn and get educated and study and sort of find where I my passion I didn't really know that when I was younger. So I love working with mob. You know, they've got so much beautiful knowledge to share, and yeah, it just always lit me up being able to, whether it's holding space or listening and learning from mob. So I was in the education department, working there for a few years, about 8 to 10 years. And, you know, an opportunity presented itself through a lot of sharing that I was doing with people, like sharing about what I love, sharing about my passion. And I was just blessed to share it with people that wanted me to win in that. So conversations were powerful, and it brought forth me working in community services. I worked with young people in the youth justice space, really delving into the core issues that they were dealing with. And we need so much more support in that space too, because it's so much deeper. It's not just a young person running amok, wanting to destroy things. There's so much more going on. So there needs to be a lot more work done in that space, especially funds provided to services to have the right supports for young people. I believe there's a lot of great work going on out there, and there's a lot of passionate people in all different spaces, whether it's government or community, non-government organisations.
I love that. Do you mind if I ask a little bit about becoming a mum at 15? I really want to touch on the space and your mahi and all that sort of thing. But I can imagine that would have been a bit of a shock and would have caused a whole lot of different ripples around you.
It was an extremely scary time for me. I had a hidden pregnancy. Nobody knew. A couple of my friends knew. It was really scary. I was in quite a deep depression and I didn't know how to deal with this. I denied it the whole way through. And then it got to a point where it's quite a funny story. So my family just thought I was putting on weight, and I joined Jenny Craig's. And I signed up to a gym, and I guess the pressure was being put on me to why I wasn't going to the gym and why my parents' monies were being wasted on these activities to help me lose weight. So I ended up, I think I was 8.5 months pregnant, and I ended up feeling the pressure of everything. And I couldn't even say it. I couldn't say the words "I'm pregnant" to my family, and it was really difficult. And eventually I was just writing hints down to one of my parents, and I was just like, you know, I didn't participate in this because of it. I haven't had my period for 8.5 months. I was trying to like get them to guess what was going on.
Same without saying it.
Yeah. And then eventually my parent come back in with my little note that I wrote and said like, "Oh, well, there's reasons why you don't have your period," like still not getting it. And I'm like, "I am pregnant." And I just hid under my blankets. It was just so massive for me to say it. So that was, you know, out in the open now. And I went to the doctors, went to the hospital, had my son the next day. So I had like 24 hours to get used to that I was going to be a mum. And it was the most incredible moment. Like, as scary as it was, there was relief that I felt being able, like, that people knew, that my family knew that I was at the hospital and I was going to be okay. If I had held on to that secret any longer, we wouldn't have made it. I was very sick, very unwell. So any young mums out there, don't be shame. Just talk about it, because yeah, we've got to look after ourselves. So it was really special having my son, and it was just all of a sudden. My dad didn't find out until my son was here, and my family could not believe it. They were just like, "No way." But he's been the most incredible blessing, both my children. And life was just, I don't know, it gave me more purpose becoming a mum.
That's awesome. Did you notice at that time that there were like different prejudices or
like how people treated you? I was just thinking some questions before, and then I was like, I guess you don't know the difference. Like, you don't know what it would have been like to not have your son. But yeah, did you notice that?
One of the really difficult time was because I was 15 years old, you know, that's like year 10, when I would go to the shops and have to deal with my peers asking me, who's the dad? And being really nosy about that because it wasn't, you know, I didn't talk. It was no one's business but mine and how I navigated that space as well. So, yeah, that was hard. I think prejudice from memory, I can't remember, like, dealing with issues. I guess I connected with a group of other young mums. There was a time where we all went out for a feed and there was a group of young people there that said some things to us that wasn't nice. But we had each other. So we all kind of experienced that together and laughed it off because they didn't know our journeys and what we had to deal with every day. And I remember being a part of a survey with King Edward Hospital, and one of the questions they asked was, what advice would you give other young mums? And I remember saying to them, I would encourage them to have a sleepover at my house and see what it's really like. It's not just like, you know, some young mums that want a baby and they see the cute little shoes you can get and just the things that you have, but they don't see the sleepless nights and the crying and the day-to-day work you've got to do as a mum.
Actually, before I had my son, when I was in the hospital, they gave me like pamphlets because initially I didn't even know how it came up on the cards, but they gave us like adoption papers and like information. And then I had him, and then I was learning how to breastfeed, and the nurse saw the flyers and she was like, oh my goodness, I'm so sorry, because she was teaching me how to breastfeed. And I'm like, oh no, he's not going anywhere. Like, he's not being adopted. That's fine. Let's continue. And I'm really proud. Like, I breastfed him for 10 months and that I could go to school.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Is there only a few schools that have that?
It's only one school, I think, in Australia. Oh. I'm not too sure if, like, other schools have popped up since. It's only in one school, Northside. Yeah. Yeah. It's a very special place in my heart, that school. I believe they tried to do it at Port School, school down here. I don't know if it's, like, what's happening with that. But, yeah.
Do you want to give it a shout-out?
Yeah. Balga Senior High School and the Teen Family Centre and the Senior High School Childcare Centre. It's all on-site. It's incredible, the wraparound support they provide to young mums.
Because there's a childcare on-site. And so I connected with that service and that was amazing. So, like, I started attending a play group with other young mums from when my son was about 4 to 6 weeks old. And then I started at that school once he was like 4 months old. And so I already felt connected to a community. And it was really cool because a lot of my peers that I grew up with were at that school as well. So I was able to not miss out on my social, like, connections in my age group as well. So, yeah, it was awesome.
Did you have different service support at the time?
I did. So just I had the normal child health nurses, but it was really when I connected with the play group that was based at the high school.
Was your daughter really different?
Yes.
Even though that was still...
Well, I got to have a normal pregnancy, and with my daughter, we, you know, I could enjoy, like, getting my belly, actually.
The rituals.
Yeah. Looking after myself, having the ultrasounds, like, just those things. I didn't know about pregnancy massage or our cultural massages back then. But if I were to get pregnant ever again, which I probably won't.
You'd come see me.
Yes. I'd love to do that. My daughter was so different. And then my just getting her room ready. My son, I didn't have a room ready for him. You know, we had to buy it. I think one of my parents were just running around buying all these things.
It's also ironic in a way. I don't know if ironic's the right word, but like that you did have the hidden pregnancy and then you had to embrace community. So it was like you did that all alone.
Yeah.
Isolated. And then you were like, okay, I'm going to let help in. And there was community.
Isolated because of the shame.
Yeah.
I had an expectation on my life that I would finish school and go to university. I had like that drive in me. And then when I got pregnant, I just thought, oh, it's all over. My world's over. So let's just pretend it's not there and go on with the day to day until I couldn't. That was a really important time in my life where community showed up and understanding it takes a village to raise a child. Yeah. You hear that saying, you're like, well, I don't have a village. But then when you sit with that and you think, what does that mean? Well, it actually means like your doctors, your community supports, all those things, right?
Yeah.
Raise a child.
Yeah.
Without it, we don't, you know, have it. We don't have the medical, we don't have the support we need.
Yeah. I didn't know that part about you.
Yeah.
And like I knew about your son and your daughter, but I didn't know that you had him at 15 and then 18. And that's both quite young. So I think that's a beautiful offering to share your experience and both the beauty of that and the challenge, obviously, but how that does influence your work, because it can't help but influence it. We're always coming as a practitioner in a way with our life story behind us and what's worked for us and what hasn't, and we're using that. So I think it's such an offering into the space that you are at.
Yeah, definitely. It's been a huge, like I'd love to work alongside young mums.
So this podcast is aimed a lot at like holding space and different professionals. How would you describe your work that you do at the moment?
How would I describe my work? Oh my goodness, it's so broad. So I work with young people that have left care, so between 18 and 21 years old. So currently that's the role that I work in at the moment. Oh, it could look so different for all my young people. We're literally meeting young people where they're at and having really connected conversations, building that trust and rapport with young people and really nurturing that as well.
So say if we're as a professional, we would have someone come into our services that we're having that same client, same people who are coming out of care. Sometimes people just get really scared, you know, like they get this weird view of like, oh, they've been in care, they must be really traumatized, like these assumptions.
I had that when I first started in this role, because you're getting a lot of information and, oh, how am I going to navigate that when that comes up for me? Even one of my assumptions or one of, I guess, a little bit of fear was around like, oh, how am I going to have conversations if one of their goals is to get a boyfriend or a girlfriend? I don't know why, because I was just like, how do I even make that happen? And then I realized it's not about making it happen or doing it for them. It's just about walking alongside them and encouraging the conversation.
I'm just laughing because I think that's a trap we all fall into with professional. You know, someone can be, say, like 8 days after a breakup and they're crying with us. So I'm a counselor, right? And then I'm like, oh, how do I fix it? It's like, you can't fix it.
The analogy of that, I don't have a magic wand to fix anything. And I always have that in my mind. And I bring it into my conversations, whether it's with the families or with a core support of that young person. I'll be like, look, I don't have a magic wand to fix anything, but let's have a conversation and see what you would like things to look like or how we want to implement other supports, and just really building like that and being clear on expectations. Because I think if you set up certain expectations or make promises, then that really causes a lot of disconnection, because then the young person or the family are thinking like that, yeah, they're going to do this and they're going to do that. But like, let's do it together and let's move together is something I've really learned from this role. Instead of me going away and doing things away from the young person, like, you know, applying for referrals and stuff, actually doing it with them, showing them how to do it so that when we're not in their life anymore, that they're going to be set up for that in the future. So yeah, I just implement that in everything I do.
I really love that with the referrals or other aspects of our job that we are doing as well. That's really good advice.
Yeah, because it's only going to set them in the future. If there's anything else that they need, they're going to be like, oh, I know how to do that. And they're going to have this confidence to do that. It's really beautiful seeing young people growing, because from 18 to 19, it looks so different. Like they could move out of home or where they were living and be in their own accommodation, living independently from 18 to 19. And then just seeing that growth in between, so magic, so amazing. They're incredible, honestly, everything that they've gone through.
Is there anything specialized in that space that maybe people outside of that area don't know? As counselors, we're seeing the whole spectrum of that journey and all the different parties. I'm thinking about both people coming out of care, but maybe people in care. I also work with people who are carers and then people who are at risk of losing their children. Mm. So we're seeing the whole spectrum. Yeah, is there anything you think that would be helpful for us?
I love this topic. I absolutely love this. Something really, you know, a baby's always better with their parents, and safety is so important, like 100%. We need to make sure our babies are safe and being cared for. I guess a specialty space or a specialty service that I've found really incredible. So I've supported young mums that have ended up coming into child safety under child protection. It opens up a whole world of risk of losing your baby, which is extremely scary and
terrifying.
Yeah. An area that I really love supporting families with is how to work with the system. They're on your doorstep and they're not going away. We need to address these things, and actually having those families trusting me in the process and having the conversations, because some young people, they want to run and hide with their babies. That's the reality. That happens. And this has been happening for years, and this is a systemic issue. It comes from colonization as well, like child protection. They rock up on your door. They're here to take your baby. So it comes from all of that, all this fear. So then if we're able to connect with whoever's dealing with child protection, that we really nurture them and walk them through the process.
So I guess I wanted to touch on that to maybe bring an awareness around like what pre-birth planning is. Within child protection, now I'm not a know all things of child protection, but when a concern is reported to child protection, and if the concern is involving a mum that's pregnant, child protection, depending on whatever the situation is, will open a case and commence something they call pre-birth planning. And what that is basically, so they've got to do an investigation into the concern that they've reported. And then pre-birth planning is three meetings before the baby's born to decide whether that baby's going to come home with the parents or with the mum. So it's a really scary time. And like, depending on your understanding of these things and your upbringing and everything, and then how the worker explains it to you, will depend how you understand what pre-birth planning is. I think when you hear the word pre-birth planning, you think of like, oh, it's just a plan on how I'm going to give birth.
Yeah, it's more like, oh, how am I, yeah, what's my birth plan?
I really think it should be more a safety plan. Like,
yeah, called a safety birth planning.
Pre-birth planning is whether the department feel that the newborn baby will be safe going home with the mum or the parents, or whether that child, that baby will be taken into care. And parents involved in these meetings have the right for an advocacy service, some FIN WA or Family Inclusion Network WA. And then they also have the right to have legal representation at each meeting. So Women's Legal Service, Legal Aid, ALS, Aboriginal Family Legal Service. There's a lot of legal services out there for families to access. I think it's just something important to be aware of, and that parents have rights.
I've had the privilege to walk alongside some young mums that have trusted me in this process and connecting them with services like Family Inclusion Network WA. Do incredible work out there. They have peer workers that will come to meetings with the department. They have that knowledge around the department and what things need to be spoken about, keeping things on track, focusing on what needs to be supported.
Because there's tick boxes, as well.
Yeah.
It's both the tick boxes, person. But also yeah. being involved in the system that you're scared of. We did some work with the Birthing on Noongar Pujarin, the number of women who actually birth at hospital and then leave straight away as well is quite high. So there's a lot of different nuances to this, which makes total sense. If even before they're rocking up now with the child protection, they were literally taking babies, like through the name of the act, but A.O. Neville. Bastard.
Yeah, devil. There's the documentary Genocide in the Wildflower State that speaks about all of that happened here. Even from a young age, the way that teachers would treat us as kids, I have always had like this justice, you know, social justice fire in my belly. And I was exposed to it, I guess, from a young age.
So shocking.
So yeah, we've really got to walk alongside parents going through this, ensuring that safety is, like, that is the common goal here, you know. But it's really unfair at times because young people that have already been in care, so there's already a spotlight on them. Then when they become mums, they're already in the system. So like certain things, whether it's domestic violence or something, it's already recorded on a system compared to if you weren't in care. There's such a big higher risk of children being brought into care if their parent was in care.
Makes so much sense. I can't even imagine if you do have that spotlight on you all the time.
My work and my practice is being able to move with these systems for the goal of them no longer being in your life and you moving on.
It's really important work. But if we are supporting, say, a young mum who's in that position where she might have been mandated to come to counselling or therapy or is struggling with that, found us in some way randomly, which happens as well, what would some suggestions be there that you would have if we're walking alongside?
I think being open and transparent and giving different options so that they can make an informed choice. So like scenarios and going, okay, I'll move with you however you want to go with this. If you're going to go this way, this is what it might look like. You know, really explaining to them the directions you could take.
Oh, that's such good advice.
Instead of like avoiding topics.
Or shaming early like that. Scenario example. I think that's really good. I find this isn't everyone. I'm more generalizing. Sometimes as therapists, we can seek safety in rules and regulations, and leading with that is not the way to connect with someone to actually genuinely make change. But it's like we're trying to keep ourselves protected above the client and person-centered care. What would be the best question for me to ask now?
I really love where this conversation's gone. I think like working with people in general, like human being, working with humans, like it, people know when people are full of shit. Like just be you with your professional boundaries and stuff like that. But be you, bring your best person forward because people are going to connect better and they're going to be more entitled to share. Whether you're in government or whether you're in community non-government services or whatever area you have, people know when you're genuine and just don't promise things. If you promise someone something, then there's like an expectation.
Not promising, you said that a few times. Is it sort of like, I don't know, I'm just relating to some things. I notice this in myself. And so as counsellors, we do a lot of supervision. So we're always looking at like, what are my biases or my tendencies? And often I find if we're in the helping spaces, we are overhelpers, we want to help. So we'll be like, I'll fix it, I'll do that before really thinking of the implications. Like, oh, I might not have a capacity. Maybe the organization I work for can't actually do that. That's actually outside of my scope.
Yeah.
All these types of things. But this person, that might be their one in time of intervention or they might not know where else to go, or they may then lose the opportunity to get another service. So it's actually a really important thing for us to be aware of, mm-hmm. of doing what we say we're going to do.
It is that. It's knowing your capacity and your scope and following through with what you said. There's power in our words, and it can create a lot of issues if you do not follow through on those things. I can't think of an example right now, but like when you say you're going to do something, follow that through.
Beautiful. I can think of some examples and situations I've been where maybe someone is facing homelessness, and because you know a service, saying you can help them with that, but referring someone to a service is not finding them a home. They're actually two very distinct things. And be really clear on that. Like, say, I can refer you to a service that does that. Not I will help you find a home. That even though your thought maybe is, oh, that'll help. Often people who are in crisis situations, I know things are easier to find sometimes and people are also very savvy, but you don't know what they do and don't have. They may not have a phone. They might not have data. They might not have transport. So a referral doesn't mean you've helped them. And I also would say, like, from a practitioner perspective, really value your supervision and look at your tendencies and be aware of them, mm-hmm. so that when they do happen, can also then say immediately, because we do make mistakes or think we can do something.
Okay, like, yeah, if it's come out of your mouth, that you can take it back. You have all the permission in the world to do that, and just in that moment, just hold it, like, I actually can't do that, but here's some options we can explore together. I can find your house. Nope. being realistic. A lot of things that I do is before, unless I've used a service, I really like to get a good idea of like their wait lists, expectations of the young person, like what the young person needs to do before I actually refer them. So I might call up a service that I have in mind for a young person and be like, do you have wait lists at the moment? I'll talk to the service first and then I will let my young person know. Yeah, give them a call, or I'll call them together with my young person so my young person can hear like how the whole process goes and what the service looks like for them. Just being really transparent with my work. I think it's sort of like working smarter instead of harder, because then we're still not moving forward. And that brings me back to like, when a young mum's dealing with child protection, is like having the focus of moving forward instead of being stuck and avoiding it.
Would you ask about like if the services have religious leanings and how that might influence, or is that something that not really comes to mind?
I haven't as much. Working with Aboriginal people, I'll always check in with my young people if they want to be referred to an Aboriginal service, because sometimes they don't want to be because of confidentiality, and it's a very small community. So that I will yarn about with my young person first. I would never do a referral or anything without their knowledge.
That makes sense. Well, I don't even know my exact question. So my first pondering initially was like, how does that feel to be Māori working in the Aboriginal space with Aboriginal people? When I first asked you, I hadn't realised you lived here since you're like young. Like, you've grown up here, so you sort of have grown up with Aboriginal people, even though we are Manukau here. But I know that you're working across Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal. Your son is so, yeah, there's that. There's a lot of different complexities that don't fit into one question. But yeah, how does that feel like culturally for you?
So it's always looking for like cultural opportunities. You know, I remember when I first connected with Haka and Corroboree for Life was, you know, hearing the call out for mob to come. And I was like, oh, this is cool. Cause that sort of encompasses the Haka side, my Māori side, and then the Noongar side with my son. Oh, great. I can connect him with his mob or like with his culture. And yeah, we went along to that, and that just opened up a whole new world for us. So, yeah, it was always really tricky navigating that space, like personally with my son, but connecting him with his family as well. And it was pretty powerful. And I guess navigating this space with like growing up here, I didn't really think of it much, you know. I just went with what my spirit wanted, and that was to work with mob. I didn't even realise, like, the huge issues that were going on until I started working community service.
It's sort of normal, eh? Like, when you're sort of around it, it's just like, oh, this is how life is.
I knew the majority of the issues. I think it's like your journey as you're growing, and I guess there's more coming into your bucket and, like, the education, the learning. Yeah, and just growing within yourself and asking certain questions and being around incredible people that actually are telling you what's going on. And then you're connecting with different communities and it's just like far out. There's so many issues I didn't know about until I started working in this space. Like just even understanding colonization and the impacts that's had on Indigenous First Nations people is huge. It's not our problem. These are problems that were bestowed upon us, you know. And I say our problem, like not our problem, because, you know, we deal with colonization and it looks different, like for each country. But there's the commonality that we've had our land stolen, which impacts so much. Yeah. So I guess it's like growing up and understanding things a bit more deep. And that there's so much more to things. And I'm really passionate about education. I think education is really important. Yeah.
I find it hard to ask sometimes what I'm asking. I'm just really curious about Māori and Aboriginal people weaving together in a way that we can be more respectful of Māori. Something I noticed in myself when I started weaving more with Aboriginal mort, Aboriginal whānau, was that I would sometimes bring this mana energy, this protest energy, and Indigenous people here, they protest in their own ways. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had to find this space. I mean, even when we were at Nainog Ball, there was heaps of Māori there. Mm-hmm. I was running into heaps of people that I know. Mm-hmm. And we are interwoven into a lot of the services for the Aboriginal community. And I think sometimes we come over from Aotearoa and we bring our idea of indigeneity and we become a bit like the colonizers sometimes and impose that view onto Aboriginal people here. That's sort of what I was trying to tie out.
I hear you. I'm with you. That is a really beautiful topic to touch on because this does can really relate to that. I think it's really important for our Māori community to learn, not assume things or that it's the same. You know, it's very different. You need to connect. We need to connect with mob. We need to listen. We need to be guided.
Patient.
So patient. This, because they're on their own hekoi to their social justice, to everything. But how do we as Māori just support that and uplift that and don't become a part of the colonising space? Like, yuck, no one wants that. So, yeah, how do we support mob with their protests, with their voices, elevating their voices? It's such a beautiful culture as well, which if you're ever privileged enough to be a part of that, that's a gift. Yeah, and there'll be times that, but there's this feeling that overcomes me and I've got to, and I listen to that. Before I didn't, and I would just keep going and I'd just be a part problem sometimes. But I've learned over time that, step back, listen, feel.
Yeah, same. It took me quite a while to grasp that aspect, but then also not disempower myself. I wouldn't say I'm with mob a lot, but the work I have been privileged enough to do, it makes it feel safer to live here when you do get to experience that connection. It can take a while, but when you do get to it, it's like worth so much and a real blessing.
And I just acknowledge those Aboriginal leaders out there in the community who love our people, love our Māori people, and really walk alongside them and lift up both ways. It's beautiful. I've seen it and felt it, and it's just so powerful.
Thank you. Something else that was popping in, it's a little bit of a side bend. How is it to work regionally as well?
Yeah, so it's a lot of driving. It's a lot of driving, but it comes with being organized, having conversations. But it also teaches my young people that, you know, I'm not based in their communities, that I'm based in Metro, and we've got to communicate and have conversations prior to me coming down so that things can get done and we can have a smooth in-person outreach together, because that connection time is really important. Face-to-face connection is so important. It's been so beautiful just going out to different communities over the last year and a half. It's been the first time I've gone out to these places. It's been a pretty awesome journey. Like, what my heart is saying, like, I wish I could connect more with the community, like with the people, with the services. I'm quite bound, so that's tricky, gating that space.
What you were saying, that sort of heart, that probably applies to everyone who would be aware of it. Sometimes there are binds, and these choices, I guess, are made for different reasons. Even health service, there's more people in central urban metro areas, but yeah. Shouldn't we care about our whole community, like the whole state, the whole country? When I worked in Ngakira, we did some research around regional areas. I was shocked, but I also had never pondered it because I don't live in that situation. If you don't live outside of Perth, you have no idea what it's like to have to book an appointment. You're from a small community. If you put someone at 8 a.m. in the morning, they have to come the evening before from wherever they live, be a 5-hour drive to get there. It's absolutely nonsensical to me in a way. Something that shocked me, there's certain situations where they have to birth in Perth, no matter where they're living across WA. There was some people, they get flown down emergency down to Perth, but then they've got nowhere to get home. Or you have to get a rebate for things where you didn't even have that money to do that in the first place. But I don't even think anyone can think about that. And there's so many others to think of, heaps more examples. Sorry, I'm getting a bit worked up.
They get put into a hotel, no food. No food and no community, no connection. They're just in this room. And I guess they do find it. They find those connections in those situations. Like, there's incredible resilience how they navigate these spaces. It just sucks that they even have to. It's like they get forgotten about. They do navigate and they do land on their feet and they do find it because they're incredible.
My partner's actually from out Wheat Beltway, and they call it a churn and burn when you have to drive up to Perth and go back at the churn and burn. And I'm always like, it's so funny. And I've gotten used to that drive now. Everyone's like, how can you drive that far? It just kind of starts getting normal that you drive back and forth.
It does. Like, I'm used to it. Me and my colleague are really used to it now. Just going to Meriden or going to Narrogin, it's just, that's part of our role. And the lack of services out there. Just say, for example, a high demand service is learning how to drive. So for young people in some towns, there's only like one driving school. And so the booking system's like where they can't book a driving lesson. Grateful in this role that I've been able to support a young person come to Perth and complete 10 hours driving lessons in 4 days. So that's cool. So really, like, being creative and looking outside the box and where we can pull funds from to actually make things happen for our young people out regional Wheat Belt areas, that's been really awesome. Like, being creative, thinking outside the box, overcoming the barriers that are there.
Thank you so much, Chelsea. This has been so beautiful. I wonder if there's anything else in your heart after all that we've shared that you would want to share that we haven't touched on.
Just some professional advice. It's really important to go to your colleagues, like lean on your team for support. Go to the colleagues that know specific areas. So, for example, the colleagues that have been a part of signs of safety pre-birth planning meetings. Go to those colleagues that have some insight, get guidance, debrief. They get it. Like, you're not going to have to explain so much and give so much of your energy. So you've just got to go to those colleagues for those guidance. All the people we work with, they all hold a particular knowledge base or experience, really encourage going to those people, the knowledge that they hold and the support they give as well. And debriefing, like I love debriefing. We hear the word debriefing. Okay, what do we think of? Some people think of like, I don't know, oh, I've got to talk about my personal stuff or, oh, it's just another thing. But to me, debriefing has always helped me leave my work at work so that I can go home and be with my family or just in my own space. Sometimes it can be just a listening ear. And when you choose the right people to debrief with, you don't need any advice. You don't need any guidance. You're just like, this is what happened, blah. Okay, I feel better. Thanks for listening. Thanks for holding space for me. Yeah, so I think that's really important to look after yourself. But yeah, my colleagues are incredible.
Yeah, 100%. I love the vision of like, when we're with a client, often we're like one-on-one. It's like me and you.
Yeah.
But supervision is like this whole group of people behind us. And debriefing, it's like those are all the people supporting you to be there for that person. And so yeah, they actually have more support if you find the right supports for you.
Mm-hmm.
And then to also be able to go home, because we have to figure out ways to do that. We couldn't carry everything we hear all the time around.
And I let my young people know too that there's a team behind them. It's not just me. Always let them know, like, because I also don't want them, like, if I go on leave or, you know, if I get a different job, that they are familiar with some of the team so that, you know.
Yeah, that I feel about.
And that's really important. It's important and it's empowering knowing that you've got a huge team behind you and that you're not alone. And in our culture, like, how we can bring forth our ancestors just wherever we are, and that we know they're here with us. You know, I love that, especially in those dark times or times of loneliness or a nervous time when you're about to public speak.
Come on the podcast.
Yeah. That our ancestors are always with us. So it's that same sort of concept in a way that I always got people that have got my back. And there's some evil people out there too. So also putting that protection around you in that spiritual sense that we're protected and our ancestor will fend off anything that comes up.
I'm just so grateful for life and the opportunities that I've had to connect with different people like yourself, my Haka for Life family, my Karabu for Life connections, all been magic, and I wouldn't be who I am today without all of those things. I'm just really grateful. I don't know how to express that, but I feel like these beautiful conversations, you know, come from setting intentions, what we want for our lives and for our futures and for people to be aware of. And things we've shared today, hopefully someone really hears something for themselves and that they can implement it in their practice or in their life.
Yeah, it's really cool. Such a great conversation.
Thank you. Thank you so much. You shared so much wisdom. I feel honored to have gotten to know you a little bit more by hearing your story and your knowing and your deep respect for this Buddha as well.
Thank you. That was a beautiful conversation.